My honor to restart the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and thank you all again for joining us in the audience. And I ask the others if they wanted to stay, and I know Mr. Powers is staying, and thank you all for all of that. The second panel is only Mr. Burke will speak, but I will have questions of all four of the panelists. We'll start with Ronald Burke, who's Assistant Deputy Undersecretary for Field Operations with Veteran Benefits Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome to Columbus. He's accompanied by Robert Worley, who's the Director of Education Service, Veterans Benefits Administrator, Department of Veteran Affairs. Mr. Worley, welcome to Ohio. Robert McDivitt, who's Director of Veterans Integrated Service Network 10, Veterans Health Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs, whom I see Mr. McDivitt pretty often. Welcome. And Dr. Cameron Matthews, Deputy Executive Director, Provider Relations and Services with Veterans Health Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs. So welcome to Ohio to you too. So Mr. Burke, give us your statement, and then I will begin the question period of all of you. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Senator Brown. Thank you for inviting the VA to this important hearing to discuss topics that affect veterans nationwide and here in Ohio. My colleagues have already been introduced. We are here today and happy to discuss the topics included in your invitation. As you know, on August 16, 2017, the President signed the Harry W. Comrie Veterans Educational Assistance Act of 2017, commonly referred to as the Forever GI Bill, which made numerous changes to the post-9/11 GI Bill. This new law enhances or expands education benefits for veterans, service members, families, and survivors. This law will, however, require a significant IT effort. Rough estimates place this number up to $40 million in addition to the authorized $30 million, bringing the IT cost to $70 million. The implementation of the Forever GI Bill will require approximately 200 additional claims examiners at the regional processing offices. VA has begun the process of bringing those full-time equivalents on board in the form of temporary employees. All employees are expected to be on board by May 30th, 2018. With regard to overpayments, VA makes every attempt to timely and accurately process payments to veterans and their family members based on benefits to which they are entitled to receive under the law. However, in certain instances where an individual is not entitled to a benefit payment, such as changes in life events or dual payments from multiple agencies, VA is required by law to recoup these payments. VA's policy for recovering these types of overpayments includes notifying veterans and beneficiaries about the reasons for and amounts of overpayment, along with the steps they must take to make repayment. VA also takes steps to minimize the overpayment amounts and has established recoupment policies that allow veterans to request repayment plans or waivers of these amounts. VBA is also committed to providing veterans with the care and services they have earned and deserve. For the eighth consecutive year, VBA has completed over 1 million disability claims and anticipates completing a record number of claims in 2018. As of October 28, 2017, VBA had 321,208 compensation and pension claims pending with an average age of 93.8 days. 22.4% of that inventory has been pending for over 125 days. For Ohio veterans, the average age of a pending claim for compensation was 97.5 days, with 22% pending over 125 days. VA's modernization efforts focus on improving its performance to better serve veterans, their families, caregivers, and survivors, while being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. As such, VBA has initiated several process improvements, leveraged operational tools such as its national work queue, and implemented new employee performance standards to improve claims processing timeliness and quality. Another way that VBA is striving to improve the veterans' overall experience is through realignment of its appeals policy and operations under its appeals management office and its work with the Board of Veterans Appeals, veteran service organizations, and other stakeholders to design a modern appeal process for veterans. The current VA appeals process, which is set in law, is broken and is providing veterans a frustrating experience. In the current process, appeals have no defined endpoint and require continuous evidence gathering and re-adjudication. Veterans wait much too long for final resolution of their appeals. With the current legal framework, the average processing time for all appeals resolved in fiscal year 2017 was 3 years. For those appeals that reached the Board of Veterans' Appeals, on average, veterans waited 7 years from the date they filed their notices of disagreement for a decision, which means that many are waiting much longer. We appreciate the committee's work on this issue, which was enacted as the Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act of 2017 and signed into law by the President on August 23, 2017. Although the Appeals Modernization Act ensures that veterans who disagree with VA's benefit decisions after February 2019 will have all of the benefits of the new modern review process, VA is also committed to addressing the 470,000 appeals that are currently pending in the legacy process. On November 1, 2017, VBA initiated its Rapid Appeals Modernization Program, otherwise known as RAMP, for veterans with pending appeals. This program allows participants the option to have their decisions reviewed in the higher-level review or supplemental claim lanes outlined in the new law. Participation in RAMP is voluntary. However, veterans can expect to receive a review of VA's initial decision on their claim much faster in RAMP than if they were to remain in the legacy appeals process. The program will continue through monthly invitation mailings to eligible veterans until February 2019, when VA expects to fully implement the Appeals Modernization Act. Now to the health-related issues that face VA. Recent research suggests that 20 veterans die by suicide every day, putting veterans at even greater risk than the general public. VA is committed to ensuring the safety of our veterans, especially when they are in crisis. Losing a veteran to suicide shatters their family, loved ones, and caregivers. Veterans who are at risk or reach out for help must receive assistance when and where they need it in the terms that they value. Our commitment is to do everything possible to prevent suicide among the veterans that we serve. VA has developed the largest integrated suicide prevention program in the country. We have over 1,100 dedicated and passionate employees, including suicide prevention coordinators, mental health providers, veterans crisis line staff, epidemiologists, and researchers who spend each and every day working on suicide prevention efforts and care for our veterans. Every veteran suicide is a tragic outcome. Regardless of the number or rates, one veteran suicide is too many. We continue to spread the word throughout VA that suicide prevention is everyone's business. The ultimate goal is to eliminate suicide among veterans via strategic community partnerships, identification of risk, training, treatment engagement, effective treatment, lethal means education, research, and data science. Although we understand why some veterans may be at increased risk, we continue to investigate and take proactive steps to understand all risk factors for all veterans. VA is also committed to providing timely access to high-quality, evidence-based mental health care that anticipates and responds to veterans' needs and supports the reintegration of returning service members into their communities. While focusing on suicide prevention, we know that preventing suicide for the population we serve does not begin with an intervention as someone is about to take an action that could end his or her life. Just as we work to prevent fatal heart attacks, we must similarly focus on prevention, which includes addressing many factors that contribute to someone feeling suicidal. We are aware that access to mental health care is one significant part of preventing suicide. VA is determined to address systemic problems with access to care in general and to mental health care in particular. VA has recommitted to a culture that puts the veteran first. Making it easier for veterans to receive care from mental health providers has allowed more veterans to receive care. Furthermore, VA is leveraging telehealth by establishing 11 regional telemental health hubs across VA's healthcare system. The VA remains focused on providing the highest quality care our veterans have earned and deserve, and which our nation trusts us to provide. VA appreciates the support of Congress, and we look forward to responding to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. You said in your testimony, Ohio's average 97 days to decide a claim, 22% of Ohioans wait at least 125 days. Walk through the claims process. It's pretty hard to understand why we can't do better. Veteran walks in, what happens?
So there are actually five distinct points in our claims process, Senator, that transpire. The first is actually putting the veteran's claim under control and initiating the first phase of development. This is where we start to go out to private treatment facilities, obtain records, or even in some cases request a VA examination. The second step in our process is the largest part of our overall inventory, and it's also the most time-consuming. About 85% of our 125-day window takes place in step number two. This is where we continue to develop for evidence. We go out to obtain every piece of information, whether it's private records, VA exam results, clarification of medical opinions, et cetera, before we make a claim, what we call ready for decision. Once a claim gets to step three out of five, that's the ready for decision, we can actually move those claims from start to finish in less than 30 days. To that end, VA just kicked off a campaign we call Decision Ready Claims, and that Decision Ready Claim initiative is designed to bypass the first two steps in the claims process. We are celebrating progress. We have not celebrated completion, because 97 days, we're not content with that. There are some claims, Senator, that we would disadvantage a veteran if we rush to a decision in less than 125 days. There are some complex claims. There are those that we need verification from other agencies, other entities, that do require longer than 125.
If there is anything like an ordinary routine claim, I guess nothing is exactly if it's you, right? But how long should it take in a case like that?
Well, if we can change the dynamics of claim filing to where the claim comes into VA fully developed with all the evidence there at that third step, our guarantee on decision-ready claims is that we will render that start to finish in less than 30 days.
How long should it take for an appeal?
Our goal under the new appeals framework is to, if you take the higher-level review path or the supplemental claim path, is to have that done on average of 125 days, and for claims going to the Board of Veterans Appeals in under a year.
Your comments about suicide are troubling, as all questions about veteran suicide are troubling. My understanding is that a veteran in Ohio is twice as likely to commit suicide as a non-veteran. Ohio's numbers are slightly better maybe than the national average, but every suicide is, as you say, is a tragedy. What can this committee do to help?
I think I'd like to engage my partners from VHA, as they're the experts in VA's efforts on suicide prevention. So if anyone from VHA would like to chime in, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Worley and Senator. The tragedy of veteran suicide, as you know, is one of Secretary Shulkin's five priorities. His only clinical priority is to prevent veteran suicide. There are a lot of initiatives going on in the state of Ohio, as you indicated. For those of us in the Veterans Health Administration, we're part of the hashtag BeThere initiative to make sure that both our staff, our community members, our partners are aware of the symptoms of suicide, are aware of what to look for, are aware of the questions that they should be asking veterans. We do SAVE training of all our staff and of community partners. We utilize the Reach Vet tool to identify veterans that are at high risk and provide special support to them. We have the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-TALK, where we encourage any veteran in crisis, family members, or others to call. The next day after the crisis is resolved, they're connected with a suicide prevention coordinator at one of our VA medical centers. We have initiated a program, Envision 10,
Let me interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator.
I appreciate your that litany, and that's important.
Sure.
Would you, when Mr. Powers talked about his attempted suicide, would anybody at the VA have known that that happened? I don't mean him personally, but if someone attempts suicide, something like his situation happened, there's a good chance the VA would not know that it happened, I assume? I'm not pointing fingers here. I'm
sure.
Just quite here.
It's certainly possible. It depends. As I said, we have veterans who are on the suicide watch list. We have veterans who are part of the REACH program. We try to connect.
He might have been on the watch list.
I don't know that.
Might have been. One thing that really stood out as I prepared for this hearing and just what I've learned on being on this committee for a decade is that I believe my understanding is that most of the suicides that happen when veterans commit suicide, most of them have not had a contact with the VA in a couple of years, correct?
Of the 20 veterans who commit suicide a day, only six are part of the Veterans Health Administration.
So isn't the most important thing for all of you to do to find those 14?
Right. And that's a key part of our initiative. We have a pilot program in this vision, which rolled out in the Toledo area to connect with churches. And we're working with over 100 churches in Northwest Ohio to, again, make members of the church aware of the what they should be looking for in terms of veteran suicide, aware of VA resources that are available, and to make those connections. And we're doing it across the board, whether it be working with Mr. Tanzel and the Ohio Department of Veterans Services, with the service organizations who were represented here, with many, many community health care partners. We do mental health forums at all our facilities, and oftentimes have 100 partners come, and at every one of those we talk about suicide prevention and how we can better connect with the community.
Thank you. Dr. Matthews, you know, obviously you know this country well, and you know the VA from the inside well. You probably know that Ohio has more opioid deaths than any state in the country. We're not the highest per capita, but we're pretty damn high, and we literally have the most 2 years in a row, and I assume that means we have some of the highest opioid addiction among veterans. Can you teach sort of civilian Ohio what works? I mean, when you answer the question of what unique or interesting or particularly successful things that the VA is doing on opioid addiction,
sure.
Understanding the state legislature has pretty much been absent on scaling up opioid treatments in this state. Understand Congress doesn't make good speeches, but don't really fund scaling up opioid treatment programs.
Sure.
Right now in Ohio, literally in Ohio, 200,000 Ohioans right now are getting opioid treatment because they have insurance from the Affordable Care Act. So understand that component, but what can we learn? What can you tell me the VA is doing well? What are your plans in the future, and how can how can the civilian Ohio learn from what you're doing in the
sure.
VA?
Sure. Thank you so much, Senator. It's an excellent question. I actually am a primary care physician as well that actually does opioid treatment, so I'm very familiar with this even during my time prior to the VA. I can definitely say up front that no state has this right yet, but one thing that I'm quite proud of within the VA is that we've jumped leaps and bounds ahead of a lot of larger health systems in the private industry with our opioid safety initiative. We've really added processes and performance metrics to what is otherwise considered this becoming the standard of care within healthcare, which is based on the CDC guidelines for approaching opioid prescribing. So we are monitoring our veterans, we're monitoring the prescribing practices of our providers, we're approaching it from a clinical perspective as far as history taking and actually dealing with pain as a larger concept as opposed to just throwing a medication at it, but dealing with causes of it, looking at non-pharmacological approaches to actually treating pain. So we're actually quite advanced and actually do have a lower rate of prescription for opioid than most of the private industry. What we're now trying to
do. Is that long-term? Is that, I mean, there's a book I commend anybody here that's mm-hmm. much about Ohio, unfortunately, from Portsmouth to Columbus, especially called Dreamland. Mm-hmm. Much of the opioid addiction in this country sort of began. I mean, the writer really does kind of tag Portsmouth, Ohio. I don't think that's entirely fair. It's the beginning over 30 years mm-hmm. and, well, 20 years, I guess. So is the VA always, is that a long-term thing that the VA, clearly, the drug companies are guilty as hell in this mm-hmm. and how they peddled these drugs saying they weren't addictive, OxyContin, oxycodone, Vicodin, other drugs, mm-hmm. Percocet and all. But, the doctors overprescribed pharma. Point fingers, we're all guilty, I guess. But have you sort of set examples in terms of prescribing, in terms of this? Tell
yes.
me how that's worked.
It's actually worked quite well. One of our expectations for VA prescribers and soon to be, hopefully in our community network as we work with other states, is the checking of state prescription drug monitoring programs. This is where all controlled substances typically, so more than even just opioids, are actually in a state level registry so that providers can look and see when the last time prescriptions were written in a specific veteran's name, can have information so that they know that perhaps there might be potential for any over prescription or just acknowledgement that treatment is already in place, perhaps with another provider, so a new prescription isn't necessary. Our pharmacy records now feed into these state programs so that even outside providers can see that the VA prescribers are now have opioid prescriptions in a specific veteran's
name. Is there a uniform policy on not overprescribing, or
yes,
would it be every bit as good in Ann Arbor, or it would be pretty similar in Ann Arbor to Chillicothe, to Dayton, yeah, to Cincinnati, Cleveland?
We have a national clinical guideline on opioid treatment that is expected across the nation. It is really equivalent to a lot of the standards of care that other health systems, in fact, in Ann Arbor, University of Michigan has one of a similar set of pain policies that at other private health systems adopt as well. So our expectation, yes, is that VA providers are following those guidelines, that our pharmacy records are looking into any prescriptions that are coming in from community providers that may be seeing our veterans so that we can attack the issue proactively.
Mr. McDivitt, shift, and thank you for that, Dr. Matthews. Talk about VA hirings and how you anticipate. I mean, one of the things that this committee has taught me and is, I mean, to stay in touch closely with not just directors in Chillicothe or Dayton or Cincinnati or Wade Park or even, you know, the community-based clinics in Springfield and Mansfield and Zanesville and all, but to also to stay in touch with the work staff, the medical personnel, and the personnel that is not as well paid and perhaps not as highly skilled as Dr. Matthews. One of the things we see is medical staff shortages sometimes aren't filled quickly enough. What do you do in Cleveland, or what do you do in Dayton to anticipate medical staff shortages so the wait times for people coming into the VA don't get longer because there's not enough medical personnel? How do you anticipate that? How do you fill those jobs more quickly?
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator.
I know it's a huge system and it's difficult. But
in our vision, the three-state area, we have around 30,000 employees. But I think, as you said, it really goes to the front line. And we hire directors, and we have three of our directors here, Ms. Hepker from Columbus, Mr. Murdoch from Chillicothe, and Ms. Hudson from Cincinnati. And we hire directors who don't spend all their time in the boardroom. They spend a lot of time out in the clinic or in the front lines talking to staff, as you do when you do town halls, seeing where the pressure points are in the organization. We do have an overall human resource strategy. We have professions that are challenging to recruit, and we try to make sure that we're ahead of the game on that, whether it be ICU nurses, some medical specialty areas. In the last year, I'm pleased to report that in the state of Ohio, we added over 380 full-time equivalent employees from the beginning of fiscal year 17 to the end, and pretty much across the board here in Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Dayton. We try not to be a market leader in our hiring process, but we try to be competitive across the board. I would also say with Dr. Matthews here, in occasions when we have short-term vacancies, and we had a short-term vacancy for orthopedic surgeons here in Columbus, we can turn to community care now, and community care can fill a gap while we're recruiting in the VA.
Is pay, I assume, isn't the same job at every VA, I assume, doesn't pay the most. Dayton's cost of living is less than San Francisco's. Do they get paid more for those jobs in San Francisco because the cost of living is higher?
There are geographic adjustments for larger markets, places like New York City and San Francisco and so on. However, our physician pay package has two components. One is a base pay, and the second is a market pay, knowing that the salaries for certain physicians, it may be more challenging to recruit someone in Toledo as opposed to Columbus or Chillicothe, and we try to make adjustments so we can compete in that market.
This is not typical in a congressional hearing, but would you introduce so people can see the directors you mentioned?
Sure. Wendy Hepker, Vivian Hudson, and Mark Murdoch are directors here representing the VAs in Ohio.
Together.
And both Mark and Vivian are military retirees. Mark retired from the Air Force. Vivian just retired last year from the U.S. Army.
Thank you. Two of you thank you for welcoming both me and my staff to your hospitals. And for the work you do. And we've seen major progress in all three of those hospitals, and it's always a challenge. And thank you for your service. Thanks for taking that question. Let me shift to something very different, Mr. Worley. This will be mostly for you, but maybe Mr. Burke too. I'm concerned that the VA was seeking blanket waivers to conflict of interest rules that would allow VA employees to benefit financially from for-profit colleges, universities. I was glad that Secretary Shulkin listened to veterans and VSOs and educators and policymakers who opposed this decision. Why was VA interested in waiving this requirement?
Senator, I think as was stated in the Federal Register notice originally, we believe that the statute had unintended and illogical consequences in its full application, meaning someone who had a job at a hospital that had entirely nothing to do with educational benefits going to a for-profit school would have to be fired or waived under this provision for attending a for-profit school where GI Bill was being used. So I think it was in that context that was, I think, a large part of the motivation.
This waiver request come out of the White House?
Well, I can't speak to that, Senator. I don't
know. You don't know or you can't speak to it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Mr.
This
Burke,
was,
you
this
know?
Was handled primarily in our This was handled primarily out of our
I mean, there has been, as veterans, more and more veterans have been cheated by some of these for-profit colleges and universities, and cheated is the right word, as not just veterans, but lots and lots of people have been cheated. They spend, these for-profit schools spend lots of money recruiting, lots of money helping you find financial aid, then they spend almost no money helping you find a job. When these for-profit universities, colleges go out of business, people, and or even if they don't go out of business, people rack up huge student debt, the diploma's not worth as much. And there is some political movement in this country to protect, in Washington, to protect these for-profit colleges and to protect their profits. And I'm just always concerned. I mean, I'm concerned as I am about the VAs. We begin to hear more and more in the news that some people inside the government want to privatize the VA. And I don't know exactly what direction that is and what that means, but you will always hear those warning bells come from my office and from a lot of us in Congress, and I hope in both parties. So thank you for that answer. I want to talk about the 90-10 loophole used to crack down on for-profit colleges and universities that use abusive, deceptive practices to recruit veteran service members and their families. As you know, it's the veterans especially, they've gamed the loophole to count veterans in that number, which is I find pretty despicable. That's why I've reintroduced the Military and Veterans Education Protection Act. Are there other improvements in the GI Bill not included in the Forever GI that would help VA better serve veterans pursuing higher ed? Mr. Worley?
I would just, first of all, I would thank you and the committee for all the incredible improvements that have been made just in my time in this job, which has been about 5 years. We've seen the educational provisions out of the Choice Act in 2014, the Blumenthal-Miller Benefits Improvements Act had 15 provisions, and of course the Forever GI Bill. These are huge improvements to so many of our beneficiaries, and have really addressed numerous of VA's legislative proposals, as well as of course numerous VSOs. I think there are a few things left to do. As I think you're no doubt aware, I think it's called the Valor Act, it was recently passed, which will help us with apprenticeships. I mean, off the top of my head, I'd have to go back to our 18 budget proposal where we had our various legislative proposals. But there are fewer of those out there because the Forever GI Bill covered so many of them.
Okay, thanks. You want to add anything, Mr. Burke?
Nothing else to add. I think Mr. Worley is the expert with the GI Bill world, but I would like to echo the appreciation for the support in getting the large overhaul done that Rob mentioned.
Okay, thank you.
Last
question of the hearing, and if any of you want to add anything else, I'm certainly open to that. One of the real successes, I think that hearings like this and reading newspapers and
going online, we hear only about the problems and the waiting lists and the people that fell through the cracks or when government doesn't do a good job. Well, some years ago, the VA, I believe it was Shinseki, it may have been Principe, I'm not sure, set a goal on homelessness to eliminate homelessness among vets, understanding actually getting it to zero was virtually impossible. But since 2010, we've reduced veterans' homelessness by 47%. The HUD-VASH voucher program has been instrumental in making this progress. It helps veterans. And we know, as I said before, and Shinseki actually told me this when he was Secretary of the VA, that Chillicothe may be the single best homelessness program center of any of the VA hospitals anywhere. Unfortunately, in September, the VA decided to take dedicated HUD-VASH supportive services funds and combine them with other funding needs in a general purpose fund, which meant housing and veteran service organizations in our state, I think our directors could probably speak to that, and across the country are concerned that this decision will undermine the success of the HUD-VASH program and set back our efforts as we've made measurable, significant progress in reducing homeless veteran population since 2010. Is any chance, Mr. Burke, the veteran would that VA would reconsider this decision? And if not, how do you plan to ensure that they are going to remain steady to support the struggling veterans across Ohio that are on the edge of homelessness?
So, sir, that's a great question. I'm going to ask my colleagues from VHA to chime in as well. But I will say we haven't given up the fight trying to eradicate veterans' homelessness. In fact, we're using tools and technology such as our national work queue to move those veterans with pending claims that we know are homeless kind of to the front of the line to expedite decisions on that. And Mr. McDivitt, if you want to add anything.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Burke. This is a very important issue to us, Senator. As you know, the decision you talked about is actually on hold right now. I think that the committee had asked that it be reconsidered, so it's on hold. Regardless of how it plays
decision
out,
decision to move the funds
to
out
move
of VA.
The money from special purpose into the general purpose fund. Regardless
and
of how
do we,
it plays
how do we,
out,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Sorry, how do we get that putting it hold, putting it in the trash? For want of a better term, putting that decision, you said that decision's on hold to make the move. How do we get that decision to be permanently on hold then?
Well, there's an active debate with the CFO and the Veterans Health Administration about that, and my network director colleagues and I had a chance to talk with him last week. I would say ultimately, whether the money comes as special purpose or it comes as part of the overall appropriation, it will come here to Ohio. And it will be part of our overall homeless program. Dr. Jesse Burgard, our mental health lead for the Vision, oversees those programs. We have a coordinator for the state of Ohio, Jim Keneally. We have homeless veteran coordinators at all our facilities. And the HUD-VASH funding will continue to come here. It may not come as what we call special purpose dollars, but it would come as part of the overall general appropriation. So the commitment to homeless veterans continues to be very strong here in Ohio.
I think about two things that have been brought up here. Congresswoman Beatty, in her opening statement, said something very passionately about the people that it's our duty to serve those who served us. And I don't know if that's a slogan at the VA, but it should be. And I know that all four of you have dedicated a big part of your lives to serving veterans. And I know that in our previous panel that you know every witness had served this country and was now serving veterans either in a volunteer or paid capacity. And when you think of two things in particular to measure us as a nation, when you think of the veteran suicide rate and the veterans homelessness rate, and that it's really got to be more than a goal of our country to eradicate homelessness, of course, for everybody, and to eradicate suicide for everybody, but especially when we fall short, that the number among veterans is higher is something that we always need to work to ameliorate. So thank you for the work that the four of you are doing. Thank you all for joining us today. Anybody that has comments, certainly outside the process of this committee, but come to brown.senate.gov and give any comments you have, any questions, any of you as veterans, those of you who represent other veterans, if you're from the local DAV or Polish American Veterans or VFW or American Legion or any other veterans group, or if you're at a Veterans Service Commission office in a county, certainly feed any information directly to Jonathan or Anna in my office, or Amber in the back, or directly to me. So that's my job, to represent you in that way. I so appreciate all of you who came. The three directors, thank you for joining us, and the four of you up here. Thank you so much. The committee is adjourned.